Thank you, Mr. Smith. Good afternoon to everyone. We're in this time between the days of unleavened bread and Pentecost, so it's a good time to think about our Christian lives. Of course, it's good to think about your Christian life every day. Have we grown? Have we made mistakes? And if we've made mistakes, have we repented and learned from them? Or do we just happen to repeat them over and over again? Do our past mistakes, now repented of and completely forgiven by God, still handicap us in our own minds to think that we cannot be used powerfully by God? Today I want to take some examples out of the Bible about people who have made mistakes, and to learn from these examples, we'll see examples of major sins and wrong decisions, and we'll see examples of the wrong response and the right response. So first, let's look at an example of the wrong way to respond when we realize mistake. Let's turn to Matthew chapter 27, 1 to 5. Matthew chapter 27, 1 to 5. This is about the person that we were discussing in Bible chat, and that's Judas Iscariot. The verse 1 reads, "When morning came, all the chief priests and elders of the people plotted against Jesus to put him to death. And when they had bound him, they led him away and delivered him to Pontius Pilate, the governor." Verse 3, "Then Judas, his betrayer, seeing that he had been condemned, was remorseful, brought back the 30 pieces of silver to the chief priests and elders, saying, 'I have sinned by betraying innocent blood.' And they said, 'What is that to us? You see to it.' Then he threw down the pieces of silver in the temple and departed and went and hanged himself." So it says that Judas was filled with remorse. And it's good to feel remorse over something wrong that we have done. But Judas realized he made a big mistake, but he responded in completely the wrong way. He despaired, and he ended his own life. That was example one. Now let's go to a familiar story of an individual who responded the right way to a huge sin that he made. Let's turn to 2 Samuel, verse 12. 2 Samuel, verse 12, and you know I'm going to the story of David and Bathsheba and David's murder of Bathsheba's husband Uriah. It's a familiar story. We're not going to cover all of it. Let me jump somewhere in the middle of it and read 2 Samuel chapter 12, verse 1. "Then the Lord sent Nathan to David, and he came to him and said to him, 'There were two men in one city, one rich and the other poor.'" So the prophet Nathan has access to David, and he begins telling David this story about a rich man and a poor man. And the rich man, to feed some of the visitors that he has, actually takes or steals the poor man's lamb to provide his own guests with food. And any person with any normal sense of justice is going to say that's just wrong. And now we read verses 5 through 9. "So David's anger was greatly aroused against the man, and he said to Nathan, 'As the Lord lives, the man who has done this shall surely die.'" So David had that same response. "And he shall restore fourfold for the lamb because he did this thing and because he had no pity. Then Nathan said to David, 'You are the man.'" We have a modern saying, "You're the man," but David's inflection here was different. "You are the man. Thus says the Lord God of Israel, I anointed you king over Israel, and I delivered you from the hand of Saul. I gave you your master's house and your master's wives into your keeping, and gave you the house of Israel and Judah. And if that had been too little, I also would have given you much more. Why have you despised the commandment of the Lord to do evil in his sight? You have killed Uriah the Hittite with the sword. You have taken his wife to be your wife and have killed him with the sword of the people of Ammon." So in this case, it took another person, the prophet Nathan, to show David his sin. David was probably in some kind of spiritual slump to get involved with this adultery and murder. But even in this time of life, we can see that David still had a sense of justice, and he cried out against the injustice in Nathan's story. And basically, that's when Nathan had the chance to courageously say, "You are that man." And also notice, in this low time of David's spiritual life, he still allowed access, the prophets to access him. David didn't refuse access to the prophets, as it would seem to indicate some of the other kings of Israel and Judah did when they did not want to hear God's will. So we need to be receptive to God's correction, and sometimes it comes through another person. We do not want to be blocking that person's access to us. So once our mistakes are revealed to us, what should be our course of action? Well, David shows the right example in verse 13, 2 Samuel 12, verse 13, where it says, "So David said to Nathan, 'I have sinned against the Lord.' And Nathan said to David, 'The Lord also has put away your sin. You shall not die.'" So David repented. He was forgiven. However, of course, there were still some consequences that David's action brought. And even though he was forgiven by God, those consequences still had to play out. Let's go to Psalm 51, because this is a psalm of David that he wrote after this episode in his life, and it shows the frame of mind that he had. Psalm 51, verses 1 through 4. "Have mercy upon me, O God, according to your loving kindness, according to the multitude of your tender mercies. Blot out my transgressions. Wash me thoroughly from my iniquity and cleanse me from my sin. For I acknowledge my transgressions, and my sin is always before me. Against you, you only, have I sinned and done evil in your sight, that you may be found when you speak, that you may be found when you speak, and blameless when you judge." So that's an example of the right way to respond to a mistake, to a sin. Let's go to example number 3, another person who made a major sin and mistake. Matthew 26. Matthew 26. And we'll rehearse a little bit the familiar story of Peter's threefold denial. Let's go to Matthew 26, verse 31. Matthew 26, 31, and we'll read to verse 35. "Then Jesus said to them, 'All of you will be made to stumble because of me this night, for it is written, I will strike the shepherd, and the sheep of the flock will be scattered. But after I have been raised, I will go before you into Galilee.' Peter answered and said to him, 'Even if all are made to stumble because of you, I will never be made to stumble.' And Jesus said to him, 'Assuredly, I say to you, this night, before the rooster crows, you will deny me 3 times. Peter said to him, 'Even if I have to die with you, I will not deny you.' And so said all the disciples." Now let's go to verse 69 and read to verse 75, and we'll see how all this plays out later. "Now Peter sat outside in the courtyard, and a servant girl came to him saying, 'You were also with Jesus of Galilee.' But he denied it before them all, saying, 'I do not know what you are saying.'" That's denial number 1. And when, verse 71, "And when he had gone out to the gateway, another girl saw him and said to those who were there, 'This fellow also was with Jesus of Nazareth.' But again he denied with an oath, 'I do not know the man.'" Denial number 2. "And a little later, those who stood by them stood by came up and said to Peter, 'Surely you are also one of them, for your speech betrays you.'" Peter had this Galilean accent, which in Jerusalem probably sounded like a country bumpkin accent. "Then he began to curse and swear," cursing and swearing now on top of the oaths, "'I do not know the man.' Immediately a rooster crowed, and Peter remembered the word of Jesus who had said to him, 'Before the rooster crows, you will deny me three times. So he went out and wept bitterly. As Peter was weeping bitterly, perhaps he remembered the words that Christ said to him in Matthew 10:33. You don't need to turn there, but Christ said, "Whoever denies me before men, him I will also deny before my Father who is in heaven." So perhaps we can imagine that Peter was remembering those words as he wept bitterly. But after the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ in John 21, if you could turn to John 21, we see Peter and some of the disciples fishing in the Sea of Galilee. And Christ says some words to Peter to make sure he understands that Peter has a special mission in front of him. And in John 21, let me read verses 15, 16, and 17. John 21, 15. "So when they had eaten breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, 'Simon, son of Jonah, do you love me more than these?' He said to him, 'Yes, yes, Lord, you know that I love you.' He said, 'Feed my lambs.' And he said to him a second time, 'Simon, son of Jonah, do you love me?' He said to him, 'Lord, you know I love you.' He said, 'Tend my sheep.' He said to him the third time, 'Simon, son of Jonah, do you love me?' Peter was grieved because he said to him the third time, 'Do you love me?' And he said to him, 'Lord, you know all these things. You know that I love you.' Jesus said to him, 'Feed my sheep.'" It's interesting that Peter denied Christ three times that night. Here, Christ three times says, "Feed my lamb, tend my sheep, feed my sheep." And in verse 18, "Most assuredly, I say to you, when you were younger, you girded yourself and walked where you wished, but when you are old, you will stretch out your hands, and another will gird you and carry you where you do not wish." So this is a prophecy that Peter's work would eventually result in his arrest and his death. And we know in Acts chapter 2 that God uses Peter very powerfully in the history of the early New Testament church. It was Peter's bold sermon on Pentecost that year that was used to convert 3,000 people that day. And as far as God was concerned, Peter's denial several weeks beforehand was long gone, forgotten history. Peter made a mistake, but he repented and he was forgiven, and God used him powerfully until the day he was martyred. Those are three examples, and now the fourth and final one today, which I'll spend the rest of the time on. It's a pretty remarkable example of making lots of mistakes and sins, but growing and changing and learning from that. This example involves one of the 12 sons of Jacob, and this is his son Judah. So let's turn to Genesis 37. Genesis 37. We're sort of jumping into the story about Joseph, one of Jacob's other sons, but we're going to focus on Judah. You remember the story. This is the chapter where Joseph is sold into slavery by his brothers. You remember that Jacob loved Joseph more than his other sons. That kind of favoritism isn't usually helpful. But Jacob loved Joseph because he was the firstborn of the wife he loved the most. And the other brothers were very envious and had designs on killing Joseph. So let's go to verse 26. This is Genesis 37, verse 26. "So Judah said to his brothers, 'What profit is there if we kill our brother and conceal his blood?' Verse 27, 'Come and let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother in our flesh.' And his brothers listened." So instead of killing Joseph, it's Judah who proposes, "No, let's sell him into slavery instead." And then, of course, the brothers had to all be involved in a deception and deceit of their father to convince him that Joseph was killed by a wild animal. And of course, Judah was part of this deception. Now let's go to Genesis 38. And this is a very interesting chapter because it's an inset chapter within this whole story about Joseph. And it focuses on Judah. The purpose of this chapter, there's probably a number of reasons, but one of them simply is to contrast the righteousness of Joseph versus the unrighteousness of Judah. Now, in verses 1 through 10 of this chapter, we read about Judah's first two sons. And both sons were specifically struck down and killed by God. In verse 7, it says, "But Judah's firstborn was wicked in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord killed him." And in verses 8 to 10, it says, "The second son, Onan, did not fulfill the responsibility of the levirate marriage. Because Onan's brother died without producing an heir, Onan now had the responsibility to produce an heir with his dead brother's wife. But as the story says, Onan just plainly did not want to do that responsibility. So God strikes him." So we have two sons directly killed by God. You know, there's all sorts of stories about wickedness in the Bible where God doesn't strike someone dead immediately. So we have to ask, were these two sons that wicked? We have to ask, what kind of parenting job did Judah do? What kind of child-rearing job did Judah do? With the best of parental intentions, children can go astray because, as Mr. Young was talking about, they have their choices. But here's a case where one's first two sons are specifically struck down by God for their evil. Now, in verse 11, we see that Judah makes a promise that his widowed daughter-in-law, Tamar, would now be given to his third son. His third son's name was Shelah when he had grown. That's verse 11, which says, "Then Judah said to Tamar, his daughter-in-law, 'Remain a widow in your father's house till my son Shelah is grown.' For he said, 'Lest he also die like his brothers.' And Tamar went and dwelt in her father's house." When we read further in verse 14, we see that Judah plainly does not fulfill that promise of giving that third son to Tamar. In the ancient world, this would be a tragic event. It would impact Tamar's life tremendously. Verse 14, it says, "So she," this is Tamar, "took off her widow's garments, covered herself with a veil, and wrapped herself, and sat in an open place, which was on the way to Timnah, for she saw that Shelah was grown, and she was not given to him as a wife." So the context here is that Tamar goes to the town of Timnah, and she has dressed herself like a harlot. And Judah is walking by that town and sees her and thinks she's a harlot and wants to procure her services. Now, perhaps she was, reflecting herself as a shrine harlot or a shrine prostitute, or maybe she might have been a common prostitute. It's not clear. But Judah gives the harlot his signet, his cord, and his staff as a pledge for her services. In the rest of the chapter, we read that Judah's daughter-in-law, Tamar, comes back home, and it's apparent that she is pregnant. And Judah, in his indignation, says that she ought to be burned. For what? For her sexual immorality. But she, of course, has the signet, the cord, and the staff as evidence that he is the man. Verse 25 and verse 26 of Genesis 38. "When she was brought out, she said to her father-in-law, saying, 'By the man to whom these belong, I am with child.' And she said, 'Please determine whose these are, the signet, the cord, and the staff.' So Judah acknowledged them and said, 'She has been more righteous than I because I did not give her to Shelah, my son.' and he never knew her again. So Judah has to make this acknowledgement. Verse 27, it says, twins are born of Tamar. Their names are Perez and Zerah. I'll ask you to remember the name Perez. We'll come to that name later. So Genesis 38 is not pretty reading, but the Bible records, of course, the good, the bad, and the ugly. But this story is in here for a purpose, and as I said, perhaps it's meant to illustrate a contrast between the righteousness of Joseph and the unrighteousness of Judah. But now let's go ahead in the story of Joseph. You remember how Joseph became second in command under Pharaoh in Egypt. And you remember how God moved Joseph to store up the proceeds from 7 bountiful years of harvest in preparation for an upcoming famine period, 7 years of famine. And when that famine finally hits the land of Canaan, where Jacob's household lived, well, then Jacob has to send his sons to Egypt to buy some food. But he sends all of his sons with the exception of his son Benjamin. And when they get to Egypt, they meet with this ruler in Egypt, who is Joseph, but of course they don't know it is Joseph. And as the story continues, Joseph sends his brothers back to Jacob with plenty of food, but Joseph requires that one brother be kept back so that the others will return back to Canaan and then bring back the youngest son, Benjamin. And so the brother that stayed back or was retained in Egypt was Simeon. The story continues, the sons of Jacob return to Canaan without Simeon, and they tell Jacob that the Lord of the land, whom they do not know is Joseph, wants to see the youngest son, Benjamin. And we see Jacob's reaction in Genesis chapter 42, verses 36 to 37. Genesis 42, verses 36 and 37. And there it says, "And Jacob their father said to them, 'You have bereaved me. Joseph is no more, Simeon is no more, and you want to take Benjamin? All these things are against me.' Then Reuben spoke to his father, saying, 'Kill my 2 sons if I do not bring him back to you. Put him in my hands, and I will bring him back to you.' But Jacob will not allow Benjamin to go to Egypt. But as we go into chapter 43, that famine gets worse and worse, and Jacob and his household do need food from Egypt. So Judah reminds his father again that they will not see the Lord of the land in Egypt unless they bring Benjamin, the youngest son. So now let's look at what Judah says in Genesis 43, verses 8 to 9. Genesis 43, 8 to 9. "Then Judah said to Israel," that's Jacob, his father, "send the lad with me," he's talking about Benjamin, "and we will arise and go, and we may live and not die, both we and you and also our little ones. I myself will be surety for him. From my hand you shall require him, and if I do not bring him back to you and set him before you, then let me bear the blame forever." So Judah accepts full responsibility for Benjamin's welfare and safety. He says, "Let me bear the blame forever." Note that Reuben earlier said, "Kill my 2 sons if I don't bring back Benjamin." But here Judah is putting the responsibility on himself and his own reputation. So the brothers now all go to Egypt with Benjamin in Genesis 43. They're able to buy food. They're received favorably by the Lord of the land. And Simeon is returned back to them. In Genesis 44, we have the story where Joseph tells his steward secretly, "Plant my silver cup in the sack of Benjamin." And let me say, the ruler's silver cup was a big thing. And so that gets planted in Benjamin's bag secretly. And when the brothers had already departed and had gone well down on the road, Joseph asks his steward to overtake them and to search their bags. And of course, that silver cup is found in Benjamin's bag. And they're all brought back to Joseph under the accusation that the cup was stolen by Benjamin. Verse 14 of Genesis 44. And this is where Judah becomes very prominent. 44, verse 14. So Judah and his brothers came to Joseph's house, and he was still there, and they fell before him on the ground. And Joseph said to them, "What deed is this you have done? Did you not know that such a man as I certainly practiced divination?" Then Judah said, "What shall we say to my Lord? What shall we speak, or how shall we clear ourselves? God has found out the iniquity of your servants. Here we are, my Lord's slaves, both we and he also with whom the cup was found." But he said, "Far be it from me that I should do so. The man in whose hand the cup was found, he shall be my slave. And as for you, go in peace to your father." So we see Judah trying to intercede for Benjamin. He says, "Take me." But Joseph is trying to continue this, and he's basically saying, "No, we got to detain the person who had the cup." Now, there's a long speech here where Joseph is continuing to intercede for Benjamin. I suggest you read it on your own time, but let me go to verse 30 and read to verse 34. Verse 30 says, "Now, therefore, when I come to your servant, my father, and the lad is not with us, since his life is bound up in that lad's life, it will happen when he sees that the lad is not with us that he will die. So your servants will bring down the gray hair of your servant, our father, with sorrow to the grave. For your servant," so this is Judah talking about himself, "became surety for the lad to my father, saying, 'If I do not bring him back to you, then I shall bear the blame before my father forever. Now, therefore, please let your servant remain instead of the lad as a slave to my lord, and let the lad go up with his brothers. For how shall I go up to my father if the lad is not with me, lest perhaps I see the evil that would come upon my father?" So Judah is willing to fulfill what he promised to his father Jacob, and that is to be surety for Benjamin. And Judah is willing to carry out this promise. He is showing courage. He is showing leadership. It's an encouraging story because Judah is honorably representing the interests of his father and his father's youngest son, Benjamin. The man who proposed selling one of his brothers into slavery before now offers himself to become a slave to save another younger brother. This is the man who did not fulfill a promise to give his third son to his widowed daughter-in-law. This is the man who earlier in life did not teach his sons to honor responsibilities and promises and responsibilities. This is a man who used the services of a harlot away from home. And perhaps this is a man who departed from the worship of the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, his father, and frequented pagan shrines. But as a result of Judah's speech, Joseph is so moved that he finally has to reveal his identity. And we see that in Genesis 45, verses 3 to 4. Genesis 45, 3 to 4. "Then Joseph said to his brothers, 'I am Joseph. Does my father still live?' But his brothers could not answer him, for they were dismayed in his presence. And Joseph said to his brothers, 'Please come near me.' So they came near. Then he said, 'I am Joseph, your brother, whom you sold into Egypt.'" Let me go back to chapter 44, verse 14. Genesis 44, 14 says, "So Judah and his brothers came to Joseph's house." So the writer of Genesis, inspired by God, is at this point referring to Judah as the lead brother of those who went to Egypt to buy food. In other words, Judah is the lead brother by the time we reach Genesis 44. Let me turn over to Genesis 46, verse 28. Genesis 46, verse 28. This is when it's time now for Jacob to move his whole household to Egypt. Verse 28 says, "Then he," that's Jacob, "sent Judah before him to Joseph to point out before him the way to Goshen, and they came to the land of Goshen." So when it's time to journey to Egypt, Jacob has given Judah the responsibility of being in the lead, pointing the way to Goshen. So how did Judah get to be in this prominent position among his brothers? He wasn't the firstborn. He was the fourthborn. Well, Genesis 49 has the last words of Jacob for all of his sons. And, of course, these words also have prophetic implication. Let me read what Jacob had to say about Judah. And that's in verses 8 through 10. Judah, this is 49, chapter 49, verse 8. "Judah, you are he whom your brothers shall praise." By the way, Judah means praise, so this is actually a little play on words. "Judah, you are whom your brothers shall praise. Your hand shall be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's children shall bow down before you. Judah is a lion's whelp from the prey. My son, you have gone up. He bows down, he lies down as a lion, and as a lion, who shall rouse him? The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet until Shiloh comes, and to him shall be the obedience of the people." So Judah and his descendants receive a pretty significant blessing in getting the scepter promise. The scepter is a symbol of kingly rulership. And the scepter promise was fulfilled in a kingly line that began from David, and David came from the tribe of Judah, and that the Messiah would also descend from the line of Judah. And again, I ask, Judah was the fourth born. Why does he receive this? Well, it appears that Reuben disqualified himself by what's written in Genesis 49, verse 4. He defiled his father's bed. Verse 4 says, this is talking about Reuben, "Unstable as water, you shall not excel, because you went up to your father's bed, then you defiled it. He went up to my couch." That defilement was with one of his father's concubines. The second and third oldest were Simeon and Levi. We can read about them in verses 5 through 7. "Simeon and Levi are brothers. Instruments of cruelty are in their dwelling place. Let not my soul enter their council. Let not my honor be united to their assembly. For in their anger they slew a man, and in their self-will they hamstrung an ox. Cursed be their anger, for it is fierce, and their wrath, for it is cruel. I will divide them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel." So they had a problem with lying. They had a problem with savage violence, temper. Now, these older brothers made mistakes. Judah also made mistakes. But those older brothers seemingly did not repent and change as Judah did. So the scepter promise was given to a man who earlier in life would not seem to be qualified to receive the scepter promise. But it appears that God saw a change in this man, from a man of dishonor to a man of honor and leadership. So this is an encouraging story of Judah's turnaround, the integrity that he developed later in life, his willingness to learn from his past mistakes, his ability to grow from that. And God can work things out, and he has given us this encouraging example. And one final point, God doesn't tempt anybody to sin or to cause anyone to sin, but even when sin occurs, God can work good out of it. So if you look at the genealogy of Mary and Joseph, given in Matthew 1 and Luke 3, The line from Judah to King David to Jesus Christ goes through not Judah's third son, Shelah, but through the one of the twins born of Tamar in that that illicit encounter that Judah had with Tamar, his daughter-in-law. And that was the son Perez. We can always ask why God didn't take the genealogical line through Judas's third son, but God had no problem with having King David and the line of Christ descend out of Perez, one of the twins out of Tamar. God can work in ways that our finite minds do not expect or do not understand. So I asked at the beginning of this message, are we growing? Have we made mistakes? And if we made mistakes, are we learning from them? Are we growing from them? Are we moving forward? From these examples today, let's respond to our sins the right way. Let's not despair in the way Judas did. Let's be open to the correction from God and repent like David. And even when major sins and mistakes are in our past, as with the case of Peter, let's understand that we can still be used powerfully by God, because upon forgiveness of sins, he has long forgotten those mistakes and sins. And if our past is lined with a pattern of mistakes and sins, like we saw with Judah, through the guidance and help of God's Spirit within us, we can change and grow as Judah did.